closer.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome aboard our flight to Los Angeles today. In preparation for departure, please bring your seat backs and your dining trays to their full upright and locked positions. Check to be sure that your seatbelt is fastened low and tight across your lap, and then all your carry-on luggage is stowed completely underneath your seat, leaving the aisleway totally clear. Also, all portable electronic devices should be turned off and stowed as we get ready for our departure. Once again, welcome aboard.
I know you've heard that before. I'm positive you've heard that. If you haven't heard that, I'm really jealous of you. If you've heard it a million times, then you travel too much. But I know you've heard that before. Hi, everybody. I'm Todd Conklin, and this is the Pre-Accident Podcast, and I think you're going to like today's episode. In my never-ending quest to find interesting people to talk to, I tapped a safety professional that may, in fact, be someone you wouldn't think of. In fact, I would suggest there's an entire population of safety professionals that we probably don't get to talk to very much because I'm not sure we think about that job as primary function to what they do. But in the aviation industry, certainly flight attendants have a primary safety role. And I've always wanted to sort of sit back and talk to somebody who does this for a living and kind of dig deep and see what is it they do, how do they drill, and what's some stuff we don't know that we should know. And there's quite a little bit of surprise in this. Quite honestly, I was pretty stunned by a couple things, but I shouldn't talk about them yet because you probably ought to hear the interview. This is Chris Basor, and he works for a major carrier, and he works in the training area. His entire job is in flight. That's what they call it, in flight. And Chris does a tremendous amount of work with in-flight personnel, both in their initial training and in their ongoing training. But what he really does is a tremendous amount of instruction. So I thought this would be interesting. I mean, there's plenty for us to learn, and it's something that we are familiar with, and it's something that if you're not familiar with, you soon will be, because the next trip you take, I want you to think about the job a little bit differently. So sit back and relax. We're going to talk to Chris Basor. Now, he's not going to talk about his airline per se, because that seems to be a little bit of an issue, but he's going to talk directly about the industry and kind of this non-specific discussion in the industry, I think you'll find very, very enlightening.
Well, the reality is that the flight attendant is truly the first responder in the event that there is some type of incident or accident, either in the air or on the ground for passengers traveling aboard aircraft. And so because this isn't a frequent occurrence for each individual flight attendant, it's part of their job to just be prepared for potential incidents. And so they go through quite a bit of training for accidents.
How much is quite a bit?
Well, it depends on the carrier itself, but it's, I would say that a training course for a flight attendant is going to be anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks long.
Wow.
The length of time depends in large part to the number of different types of aircraft a carrier flies. So flight attendant has to become very, very versed in the systems of the cabin of an aircraft. So if you have a number of different types of aircraft, they have to learn a number of aircraft. So, and if you look at the actual curriculum of a flight attendant training program, proportionately, the majority of it is going to be safety-related training. And so I think it's something that the public just isn't aware of.
And do you drill the crap out of those people? How do you make sure they're ready? Because the qualification, the training, I think is really interesting. But the probability that they'll actually use this is super low. I mean, probably most flight attendants don't have an emergency. Probably their whole career, they don't have a major emergency.
I think that is a very accurate statement. Flight attendants, I think the traveling public is aware of this when they watch any kind of coverage of an aviation incident, and there is interviews being done with the flight attendants. You very rarely will hear one of the flight attendants said or talk about the incident or accident at hand and cite their previous experience with other accidents.
Right,
oh,
right.
The last time this happened to me, or and so it becomes very very paramount in the training process to make sure that people are trained in what resources are going to be available, what incidences could potentially happen, and just kind of keep in the back of their mind that you're going to have to switch gears from, you know, thinking about helping people with their bags to I have to get 140 people out of this aircraft in under 90 seconds.
Say that again, because this is really interesting. So you have 90 seconds by federal statute, by law, to evacuate a plane.
Yeah. So and that is true across the board for every aircraft. So it's not dependent upon the size of the aircraft. The number of flight attendants aboard an aircraft is dictated by the number of seats, not by the number of passengers that are aboard that aircraft. So you will always be staffed based on the number of seats. And so larger aircraft, yes, they have more people or more passengers aboard. However, there's more staff to help or assist in the event there needs to be an evacuation. But ultimately, you want to have everyone out of the plane in under 90 seconds.
How serious are you guys about this safety stuff? I mean, is it serious, honestly?
Absolutely. I think it's a giant focus, at least in the training that I provide and my experience in networking throughout the aviation industry in the United States with other in-flight training professionals, that we all are like that. We all want that. We all strive for that. I think all flight attendants will tell you that their job is safety.
And the pilot sometimes says that. You know, their primary function is safety. Listen to them. Pay attention to them. How do you guys drill for this? I mean, how do you train them? How do you drill them? How do you test them? I mean, do you pull people off the line if they're not serious enough about safety? How do you manage sort of the reliability of this response? And it's weird because it's a high consequence, low probability response. So the probability's low, but if it did happen, it's kind of all or nothing, and that's pretty much the cutoff. How do you train them?
Absolutely. Well, I think that it begins with just kind of basic knowledge. You have to teach people kind of equipment they have available to them, how that equipment operates, and you do some basic just paper tests, answer questions about this piece of equipment, and then it moves on to, okay, let's get the equipment out, and okay, show me how to use this. And so there are some performance or proficiency checks. And then the culmination of it is some performance drills where we are trying to simulate as close to reality as we can situations where a flight attendant will have to, you know, go back to their training and react to various situations. And we do that as a part of initial training when someone first becomes a flight attendant. And then the FAA does mandate that once a year, every flight attendant at every carrier will need to come back through a refresher course once a year. And that does involve some proficiency checks as well.
And do you guys have simulators? How do you do the proficiency checks?
We do have simulators. There's various types of simulators. We do... we have cabin simulators. A big part of the simulations that are connected to just evacuating a plane involve the operation of aircraft exits, which, depending on the type of aircraft, will also include the operation of things like evacuation chutes or slides, because aircraft are so far off the ground. In some cases, there needs to be a means for a passenger to get out of the plane into the ground without just having to jump, which could be quite dangerous at large.
For instance, like their ankles.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
So do they practice on the slides? Do you guys ride the slides?
We do ride the slides, although we don't practice actually evacuating people, because that is actually very dangerous. Going down a slide is very dangerous, and so we don't practice a mass exodus or a mass slide down that apparatus, just because the potential for injury is so great. We don't want to simulate that, and really the flight attendant isn't going to be going down that slide with the traveling public. The flight attendant's role is to be at the opening of the plane or at the exit, controlling that, so hopefully limiting the amount of injury at the bottom of the slide.
How realistic do you make the simulation? I mean, do you use smoke? Do you use lighting? Do you yell and scream?
We do use a little bit of smoke, but I would say it's more the yelling. We use a lot of loud sounds and try and get the flight attendant out of, for lack of a better better term, their comfort zone. So we practice, opening a slide or opening an aircraft door without sounds and without any kind of resistance. And then we go through it and say, okay, now when you're doing this, don't forget you have specific commands or instructions that you are screaming to the passenger. So try that. And then we put it all together and say, all right, we're going to do this in your loudest commanding voice. We're going to have sound effects. And also don't forget, time is of the essence. We're trying to get this evacuation completed very rapidly. So there is quite a bit of repetition, because we want flight attendants to be able to react without having to think much about what they're doing.
Which is brilliant, right? So you practice under high stress in order, if they need to, they respond under that same stress situation. Does everyone make it, or do people?
Absolutely not. Not everyone's cut out to be a flight attendant. I think in best terms, the job is very, very unique. The schedule is chaotic. The working conditions are not the same as sitting in front of a computer terminal for a set 8-hour shift, or it's pretty rigorous. There's a lot of physical demands on the people who choose to be a flight attendant.
Do people get hurt? What do your injuries look like? Do you have injuries?
Injuries for flight attendants?
Yeah, for the flight attendants.
On like a day-to-day basis?
Yeah.
Sure, flight attendants do get hurt. They get hurt in ways that I would say are not probably seen by the public, in that the public is, in I would say the majority of times, or the most serious, or some of the most serious injuries to flight attendants have to do with turbulence. So turbulence is a very scary, dangerous thing.
Think about that. I bet so. Because they're up walking around and stuff.
They are up walking around. And while the flight deck crew does their best at trying to foresee any kind of potential danger that the plane could be encountering, and giving the cabin a good enough heads up to get everything secured, sometimes turbulence hits out of nowhere. And that can be very dangerous for flight attendants, or for anyone for that matter, but flight attendants especially, if they are also trying to get something like a beverage cart or a service cart stowed and get themselves stowed, and passengers may still be up. So they're kind of juggling a bunch of different safety hats.
Yeah, a bunch of different priorities. What's your guys' relationship with the flight deck, especially as it relates to like crew resource management?
But there needs to be a very good relationship between.
How do they ensure that? What do they do? You train for CRM? Or?
We absolutely do train for CRM, and the FAA does require a certain amount of CRM training or crew resource management training. It's a tricky topic for I think most airlines for a couple reasons, and I think that is if you break it down to into just a basic communications class, that makes it rather difficult to teach, because I think that when you're wanting to teach an effective communications class, the first thing that any instructor would do would be to look at the potential audience, and the potential audience would dictate to the instructor how to facilitate that class, what you would want to have as results from that class. And I think that just by sheer whatever you want to call it, without offending anyone, the communication needs of cabin crew is very different from that of the flight deck.
Is there a class system? Is there a clear delineation? I'm a pilot. You're a flight attendant.
I wouldn't say it's not like that. I think, and I can't speak for every carrier. I feel like at the carrier where I currently work, it's a very good relationship. I think both sides of the flight deck door do respect and understand that the other side has a very important critical job to do, and that it is difficult. And so I think they both sides value what the other do and don't see what they do as more important. I think it's definitely viewed as a cohesive unit. You have to work together. Consequently, CRM is important. You have to be able to communicate. That's not to say that the issues don't come up, but that's the purpose of then having the training.
So do you bring pilots in when you do training, so they can interface with pilots and feel comfort or whatever?
Absolutely. We the carrier where I work, we do what is called joint CRM. So the FAA mandates that CRM training does have to be done both for flight attendants and for the flight deck crew. Now, there is no mandate currently that says it has to be a joint class. However, we choose to make it joint. We can't always have it as a joint class just because we have more flight attendant classes than pilot classes. So by the numbers not agreeing, we can't ensure that every class is joint. However, what we do have is that we have representatives of both work groups as instructors.
And, oh, that's a good idea.
And they're always there.
Yeah, that's
so,
a good idea.
And because of the nature of that class lending itself to quite a bit of group participation, both halves, for example, as a flight attendant instructor, I would say that after doing it seven or eight times, one curriculum, I get to the point where I know how flight attendants are going to react to a part of the module or a statement within the module, or a good idea. And so that if there has to be a class where flight attendants can't be part of the class and I'm the only flight attendant in a pilot class, I can throw into the mix what has been said in the past.
Yeah, that's so good. What do we need to know that we don't know? Like one time you told me that seatbelts upon stress can stretch, would you say 2 inches
yeah.
more? What things do you guys know that we should know?
What things?
You know, the interesting crap you know.
The interesting crap that I know.
That we don't know.
That you don't know.
That's it.
I think certainly the seatbelts. Seatbelts are critical. Getting your seatbelt as low and tight. So I think sometimes people don't wear their seatbelt as low as possible because your seatbelt's going to ride down, if you will, a little bit. So if you're a little bigger up and you have it tight up and it rides down, then all of a sudden it becomes very loose and the seatbelt could be actually almost more dangerous than it would be good. So I think making sure that you have your seatbelt as low and tight as possible, always figuring out where the exits are. I think that is brought up quite a bit, but not only knowing where the exits are, but taking a second to close your eyes because it's very possible that you would have to find that exit in darkness. So understanding, counting the rows. So
that's a good idea, yeah. What about those oxygen masks? Okay, be honest. Do they really work?
Those oxygen masks really do work.
Really?
They absolutely
They look
do.
So cheap.
They look so cheap. How often is it you've seen one?
One time we landed and they fell out.
That's okay.
The only time I've ever seen them.
So,
other than the fake one, I see that every day.
Well, the fake one is just that it's fake. It's not even it's in shape is about the only true representation of that toward the masks that actually drop from that service unit above your seat. So the oxygen masks are very effective if you're not aware, cabins are pressurized so that we can fly at a higher altitude and be able to breathe. But if that cabin pressurization system fails, we need to be able to breathe because hypoxia or oxygen deprivation is quite dangerous. Obviously, can lead to death, but the more immediate danger or the more disturbing part of hypoxia is that if it's slow, if it's a slow decompression, the symptoms of that kind of oxygen deprivation aren't necessarily terrible. You feel good. You feel giddy. You feel
really
happy. And so you're not even – a lot of times you're not even aware. But the higher the altitude, the shorter time of useful consciousness you have.
How much time do you have it?
Well, it truly depends on how high you're flying.
Okay.
And the idea I would say across the board is that those oxygen masks that fall, which they can fall one of any number of ways. One is that they can be manually activated from the flight deck. So if the flight deck becomes aware that there is a cabin pressure issue, they could, from the flight deck, activate those. Flight attendants, really, or passengers, could activate those as well from their own seats. And then the last is that they do automatically drop when cabin pressure has reached a certain elevation, air altitude. Those oxygen masks are activated by pulling down. So there's little canisters in each row.
Oh, really?
So one row is going to have, well, at least on our plane, because there's 3 seats, there'll be 4 masks in there, accounting for the possibility that one of the people in that row might have a baby on their lap. So there's the oxygen mask, and so those masks, once one of the masks is pulled, oxygen is coming to all 4 masks at that time, and they're going to last about 10 to 12 minutes, which is, coincidentally or not coincidentally, is the same amount of time that the flight deck is shooting for to get to a safe breathing altitude, meaning let's get to an altitude where if we didn't have the mask, we would be okay. So What the masks do is there's little canisters up in the compartment, and it shoots oxygen into the bag, and then the person wearing the mask will actually breathe in and exhale, and as they exhale, their exhalation will go into the bag, mix with the air that's in the bag, and they will then inhale that. So what you're breathing in isn't just pure oxygen. It's a mixture of what you're exhaling with the oxygen coming from the canister, which is why in the demonstration or the safety announcement that happens, passengers are instructed to, your bag may not inflate. Because
right.
I think
yeah.
the perception is that this bag is going to be this big giant supply of air, and I'm going to breathe it in, and I don't know where they think it's going if they exhale, but it's certainly not going to go back in there.
Into the seat cushion.
Into the seat cushion.
Where all exhaled gases go on a plane.
Right.
So what's your funniest story? You must have a good story. What's your funniest story?
Funny, peculiar, funny.
You can pick.
Uh-huh.
You can make it funny in any way you want to define funny.
That's an impossible question to ask a flight attendant.
Crap, any I thought it was a clever one.
Well, here's the reason why, and I think anyone who's been a flight attendant could attest to this, that when you're a flight attendant, you have some amazing opportunities. And one of those opportunities can often be that you get to spend time laying over in cities that where you have friends or family, and so you'll get to see them, and you'll go and you'll see them, and something crazy will have happened to you that day, something that is just so far you can't even believe how nuts that is, and you'll tell them, and then a couple months later you'll go back to the city and they will remind you of that, and it will have completely slipped your mind because you've had something like that happened every day since then. And so I think it's there's quite a bit of hilarity that I think that happens aboard an aircraft.
So let me ask this question. Listen,
sure.
Can you tell when people are getting in the Mile High Club? That's what I want to know.
Absolutely.
You can?
Absolutely.
Can you just turn a blind eye? Professional courtesy?
Well, that's – you're asking for, carte blanche. Absolutely not. I mean
– Oh, darn.
Well, I mean, what you're saying –
Wait, do you have to be with another person?
I did not say that.
I was just wondering.
But remember, we do have rules on the plane. Not against that. Not against multiple people in the bathroom. But there is a seatbelt sign. And so when that seatbelt sign is on or illuminated, people have to be in their seat. No matter what club they're trying to join there.
Hey, thanks for your time. Anything we're missing? This was really helpful because I think you guys are sort of an unsung category of safety professionals. I'm not sure that we think of you guys as peers, but in fact, I think with the people who listen to this podcast, you're very much peers. You're absolutely peers to what we do. Anything we missed?
I just think that people should understand that when flight attendants are asking for you to do something or comply with something, it's not harmful ever to ask why. You know, if you're curious to know why is this the rule, because I think flight attendants are very, very open about the need for safety. But don't always assume that it's just because someone's being a creep. And if you see someone giving a flight attendant a hard time, really look at the person who's giving the flight attendant a hard time and remember that the flight attendant's trying to protect you from that creep.
From that same crazy person.
And there you have it. Everything you've ever wanted to know about the Mile High Club and a bunch of other stuff. So the whole 90 seconds thing is really interesting. That is actually a pretty tight stopwatch to take an entire plane full of people out of a plane. And the seatbelt stretching thing is very interesting to me as well. So I enjoyed that. It was good. Hey, as always, if you like the podcast, subscribe. That helps out a ton. And tell your friends. Until then, be safe.